Timing is firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Cut, Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. And it is 19 hours UTC on Saturday, October the 7th, in the glorious future year of 2023. And this is, of course, not a news and current affairs show per se, but I do talk about news and current affairs sometimes, and so I think I'll start today with a piece of good news, unlike the guy who employs this time slot Monday through Friday at this time, who is very much a bad news kind of a guy. So what good news do I have to share? Well, I mean, most of the good news I have, of course, is qualified good news. But still, the first fuel for the Rohpur nuclear power plant in Bangladesh has officially been handed over, which adds Bangladesh officially to the list of nuclear power countries, even though the reactor in question, Rohpur number 1, is expected to start up sometime next year. The 1 and 2 at Rohpur are Russian VVER-1200 pressurized water reactors, and the fuel is being furnished by Russia as part of their usual turnkey arrangement, where they agree to supply the reactor and the fuel for the operating life of the plant and then take it back when it's exhausted. Now, a couple of comments here. One, of course, is that Rohpur was a site picked by the old Pakistan Atomic Energy Commission for a second unit similar to the Karachi nuclear power plant, which is now considered Karachi Unit 1, because there have been a couple of Russian VVERs installed there, too. But, yeah, those plans were, of course, made in the late 60s, and then the Pakistan Civil War, which ended with the separation of East Pakistan, now known as Bangladesh, from West Pakistan, really just put an end to those plans. It took Bangladesh a long time to get back on its feet, and in the meantime, the United States in particular had begun pressuring other nuclear supplier countries not to supply nuclear power plants to countries which desperately needed energy. Stupid move, don't you think? And of course, the Canadians at the same time, after the Indians and their 1974 detonation of a nuclear explosive using plutonium produced in the Canadian-built research reactor at Trombai, not on a power reactor, the Canadians sort of lost interest in further CANDU export sales. I have talked about Cernavoda. That was about the last one. The CANDU in Argentina, believe it or not, was actually built by an Italian firm. Sublicensing, essentially. I think that's actually kind of nifty, because it shows that pretty much anybody can build a CANDU. I mean, I think it was Turbo Mechanica S.p.A., which is a really competent heavy engineering firm, but still. Of course, the flip side of this is, what if you get into political contretemps with Russia, right? What happens if you're in a political bad way with Russia? Well, the other thing that's happened recently is the first loading of Westinghouse-produced VVER-440 fuel at Rivne in Ukraine. Rivne or Rovno, depending whether you use the Ukrainian or Russian pronunciation, but it's not that important. The important part is that there are a lot of VVER-440 reactors in the world, because it was a standard Soviet export design. And so there's they're the major source of nuclear power in Central and Eastern Europe. now that Germany has idiotically shut down its remaining nuclear power plants, and indeed, the people in charge of the last few are actually violating the law in order to make it more difficult to bring them back online. That's another story. So now, Westinghouse is, which has, I believe, already produced VVER 1000-type fuel. The 1200 and the 1000 are very closely related. So Westinghouse has been producing VVER fuel for years, but they're now producing VVER 440 fuel bundles, which means that Hungary, Poland, Slovakia now have a second source for fuel. And this is something which is desperately wanted by the Central and Eastern European countries. Except, of course, Romania, which has its CANDUs and so doesn't need to get away from Russian fuel, and Slovenia, where the Yugoslavian nuclear power plant in Slovenia is actually a Westinghouse plant anyway. They just bought U.S. The Yugoslavians bought American. I think that was intended as one of their periodic gestures of, we're not really all that closely aligned with the Soviet Union. Anyway, so some good news, some stupid news. For one thing, Russia has threatened to denounce the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. Now, the Test Ban Treaty is a dead letter. It's got to be emphasized. The CTBT can only enter into force when it is ratified by the Big Five. And the United States has made it very clear that the United States will never ratify the CTBT. So Russia withdrawing from it, saying, well, we can test nuclear weapons if we want to, is primarily a symbolic step. But it's clearly meant, as with a lot of other things Russia is doing, to make Russia appear threatening and powerful, whereas what it really makes Russia appear is pathetic. Now, there are interesting questions which can be raised. The thing is, I don't like the CTBT. I would be perfectly happy without it, or at the very least with a major renegotiation of the CTBT. Because, unlike the Limited Test Ban Treaty, unlike the Non-Proliferation Treaty, unlike the Treaty of Tlatelolco for the prohibition of nuclear weapons in Latin America and the Caribbean, the CTBT purports to ban all nuclear explosions of any type for any purpose. And I am unashamedly a believer in the potential of nuclear explosives for civil engineering purposes, at least to the extent that I don't think we should foreclose on that. I think we should leave the possibility open. So, Russia pulling out of the CTBT, per se, is really a meaningless gesture. It's the political implications, right, the rationale behind the gesture, that bother me greatly. Now, if it were to bring about a renegotiation of the CTBT with a recognition of the positive obligation that the weapons states are under, according to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, to furnish peaceful nuclear explosion services to non-weapons states on request, then I might be more interested. But I don't think that's likely to happen anytime soon. And the plain fact is that the other reason that I don't cry over the CTBT is that the CTBT organization, the people who are actively in charge of enforcement, now it's never entered into force, but the organization for enforcing it was created. And they do various things. They maintain stations, seismometer stations and things for monitoring possible nuclear weapons tests around the world. The thing is, I remember 15 years ago or so, you know, when websites were for official organizations were a relatively new thing, going to the CTBT website and seeing their statement that we're here to protect the world from all the for the horrors that could be unleashed by the uses of nuclear energy. The people running the CTBT organization are anti-nuclear in every sense of the word. They're not just here to try to reduce the risk of a nuclear war. No, they want to end all uses of nuclear energy for whatever reason. Right. So, and as I've said before, that really only augments rather than diminishes the danger of a nuclear war, because wars are often fought over resources, and particularly energy resources. And so if you ban nuclear energy, which reduces the pressure on all other forms of energy resources, then you increase the likelihood of wars. And the only war in which nuclear weapons have ever been used was a war over oil. X1 and COM is rhapsodizing over the Orion drive using nuclear explosives to propel spaceships, which itself would is an extremely dubious position under the Moscow Treaty, which bans nuclear weapons tests in outer space. Doesn't necessarily ban operational uses of them for peaceful purposes, but that's not covered under the Peaceful Nuclear Explosives Treaty, which only discusses underground explosions. So, an interesting news item about the launch of a group of satellites under Amazon's Project Kuiper. This is another stupid low-orbit commsat constellation. So this was a ULA, and this is an Atlas V launch carrying two demonstration satellites. They've purchased 9 Atlas V launches and 38 Vulcan Centaur launches. And that's what's really interesting here, not their stupid low-orbit commsat plan, and I think really that communications authorities should start getting really serious about this. Especially since we've got other people who want to start up similar services, including Telesat of Canada. But no, 9 Atlas V launches and 38 Vulcan Centaur launches. Now this is what's really interesting to me. All right, so Atlas V is one of the two EELVs, the Evolved Expendable Launch Vehicles, which came out of the U.S. Air Force, basically, in the late 1990s, and they were supposed to be cheaper than existing launch vehicles, and very, very stunningly have not been. Now, if Amazon is trying to compete with SpaceX, right, and Starlink, then presumably they're looking at low cost to orbit. And Atlas V has not delivered low cost to orbit, so I'm wondering what kind of sacrifice pricing ULA is giving Amazon in exchange, and also what they're getting for it. One part of what they're getting for it is very obvious. The Vulcan Centaur is to be powered by engines built by Blue Origin, which is, of course, the basically Jeff Bezos space company. This is very interesting. See, the problem with the Atlas V is it uses Russian-built engines, and although legally Rocketdyne is supposed to be able to produce them under license, they never tooled up to do it, and they have no real interest in doing so. That was purely a legal fiction, almost, which allowed them to sell the thing to the Air Force, because, the Air Force wasn't going to buy something that required foreign-sourced components, especially foreign source components from a possibly hostile country such as Russia. So Rocketdyne signed an agreement with Energomash saying, oh yes, we can build the engines under license, but they've never actually tried it. Anyhow. But yeah, so 38 Vulcan Centaur launches. Now, the Vulcan Centaur hasn't flown yet. The Vulcan Centaur is supposed to have lower costs than the Atlas V. Last I heard, they were talking about recovering not the whole booster, but the aft section, the section containing the engine, which is the most expensive part, by parachute for refurbishment and reuse. I'm not 100% convinced. Well, for one thing, I've been to the factory in Decatur, Georgia. I've been to the factory. Right, because the Vulcan Centaur, the airframe, the lower stage, is basically the same as the Atlas V, which is basically the same in turn as the Titan IV. And it's made... The manufacturing process is crazy to me, because they take slabs of aircraft aluminum alloy, 12 meters long by 3 or 4 meters wide by at least 10 centimeters thick. And then they have a colossal milling machine, vertical mill, which mills away more than 90% of that sheet, leaving a structure of ribs and pockets. And then that is bent into a curved panel, and those curved panels are welded up into a self-supporting tank structure. Now, if the Vulcan were using what the original Atlas used, the stainless steel balloon tank, which is supported by internal pressure, that's cheap. This other thing, it's still very much like throwing away, if not the avionics and the engines, certainly the fuselage and wings of a 737 airliner every time you launch the bird, which I don't know how they're going to keep their costs down. I wonder if Blue Origin has basically agreed to give them the engines for those first 38 flights for free. You know, I'm wondering if, you know, and so basically I'm wondering if the cost of those launches, a significant chunk of it, is being charged through the back door to Amazon shareholders, which of course has been how Amazon has done business from the very beginning. Right, they subsidize the prices that they charge to customers with money from shareholders. Also, they're using solid rocket boosters. Now, their latest document doesn't seem to say anything about recovering either the booster or the engine section. And if they're going completely expendable, especially with the solid rocket boosters, I really don't see how they're getting the cost down to a commercially competitive price point. Because, to be blunt, for a long time, they've not had commercial customers. They've been reliant on the U.S. Air Force. And the Air Force basically has been a captive market. Handy C just posted part of somebody's address in Nebraska into a into com. I don't know that it means anything to us, though. So what else is there to talk about? So let's see. I mentioned a couple of weeks back I was ranting about private equity funds. I should mention that the Federal Trade Commission is now suing a private equity fund. I'll remark that the private equity fund's name includes Carson, but I am not affiliated with it in any way whatsoever and don't receive any money for it from it. More's the pity, in a sense. But the Federal Trade Commission in the United States is now suing one of these private equity funds, which has bought up a bunch of medical practices, saying basically that they're violating the Sherman Act, they're doing a bunch of bad things, they're jacking up prices, and of course the private equity fund is saying, oh well, we're providing value to the consumer, or some nonsense, the way they usually try to get out of these things. Unfortunately, the Federal Trade Commission has done a lot of suing people recently that has been very unsuccessful, because we've had more than two generations of federal judges who've been brought up with Milton Friedman's bizarre reimagining of the Sherman Act, which doesn't try to protect competition at all, doesn't try to prevent the evil effects of monopoly at all, and can be gotten around by just saying, oh, well, we're going to reduce consumer prices without actually doing anything of the kind, and without observing that consumer prices are not the only... You know, jacking up consumer prices is not the only evil that the Sherman Act is intended to protect against. Anyway, The point, however, becomes more interesting because, according to the Wall Street Journal's reporting, and I have to trust them on this because it's the sort of thing they know about, with interest rates rising so that you can actually get a reasonable return on normal kinds of securities, the money is flowing out of private equity funds. Big institutional investors, pension funds, and so on, have been getting into private equity funds for years, trying desperately to keep their returns up. Well, now that yields are rising, the pension funds and so on are pulling their money out of these unconventional investments into something a little more understandable, a little more stable, a little less likely to involve shady backroom deals and possibly complete implosion, as happened with, say, FTX. Anyway, so that's kind of interesting to me, is that private equity funds are suffering. And so if we can twist the screws a bit more, maybe they'll suffer enough that they will release some of the death grip that they've had on at least the American economy, and by extension, if nothing else, the economy of much of the rest of the world. Just a thought. But I was talking last time about the mining of nickel and other minerals in northern Ontario and controversies over it. I should remark that there's at least one indigenous group which is very much in favor of the proposed mine and specifically the roads that it bring with it. Specifically, the two First Nations that are closest to the proposed mine site, simply because most of the year they're only accessible by air. And so the price of goods of any kind is really high there. I mean, the Wall Street Journal, of course, quoted the price of an avocado in a market there is, $6.50. I wouldn't even know. I mean, maybe people in remote northern Canada do use avocados, right? Maybe there are cooking enthusiasts who they are trying all kinds of nifty new recipes, and avocados is something they buy. I don't know. I don't believe I've ever bought an avocado at the market. So, I just don't like them. So I guess I'm not the person to ask about this, but I really think that they could have used a better example than avocados. Anyway, but I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking, these people are spending an enormous amount for heating oil, which can only be hauled in during the depths of winter over ice roads. They're spending an enormous amount for motor fuel for the vehicles that they have. And here is a perfect, perfect, perfect chance for the Canadian government, Canadian industry to make some smart investment decisions. Specifically, I mean, the mining company has said, well, we'll try to reduce the environmental impact as far as possible by using electrically powered bulldozers and drilling rigs and so on, and powering everything from wind and solar. Well, I mean, by God, yeah, I mean, you have long hours of sunlight in northern Canada during the summer. No sunlight whatsoever in northern Canada during the winter. Long hours of sunlight during northern Canada during the summer, but it is still diffuse and also requires clearing a hell of a lot of land. So that's not really a solution. But Canada is talking about so-called small modular reactors. Well, this is a perfect chance to install one of those small modular reactors and to run hot water pipelines from the reactor site to the two First Nations reservations, basically, right? Supplying them with heat, which they don't, and frankly, don't even make them pay for it. But that will replace their heating oil, which is their biggest expense in these communities, and cheap, relatively cheap electricity, far cheaper than the electricity they can get by burning heavy oil in diesel engines, right? So they can probably use battery electric cars and trucks. I mean, there'd be a limited range because batteries aren't great in cold weather, but to be blunt, they don't have a lot of places to go anyway. There's no road, right? The main portion of the electricity, of course, would run the mine, and probably also part of the heat. And then, a railroad, all right? Nobody really wants to drive trucks full of ore concentrate 300 kilometers and more, right, to the nearest railhead. No, no! You run a railroad spur out there, If you gave them a once-a-week passenger service on that railway, it would still be far better than what they have now, where they're essentially totally isolated except for air travel, right? Bush planes, which, you know, so if something were to happen, if there were to be a major disaster, for example, a big forest fire, what have you, they'd be in real trouble. So if we can run a rail spur out there, you know, it solves so many problems. And it's, environmentally speaking, it's probably considerably more benign than the proposed roadways would be. And, you know, again, you could even electrify that rail line. Again, you're putting in a, you know, 80 to 200 megawatt nuclear reactor, right? 8,200 megawatts of electricity. You know, again, the mine might not be able to absorb all that power, but when we throw in the railway and we throw in the villages, and you know, if they maybe could just smelt and electrolytically refine the copper and nickel and so on site, rather than even having to carry the ore concentrates, you know, to the railhead by truck and then train them to Sudbury or wherever they're planning on doing the refining. I don't know. Of course, I've been avoiding the elephant in the room, I suppose, which is, in terms of current events and news, the breakdown of constitutional government in the United States of America. Now, I've said for years that there's one thing that the U.S. ought to borrow from the Westminster countries. Now, Westminster systems have their own problems. One of the problems the Westminster system has is that in Britain, for example, the royal assent has not been refused to a piece of legislation in over 300 years, since 1708. Now, the monarch, this basically means that the monarch's role as the sort of last resort against really stupid legislation is more or less a dead letter, which I think is very unfortunate. Now, a monarch with a strong spine, such as perhaps the late Queen Elizabeth II, such as probably not her son, the current Charles III, can perhaps persuade the government of the day not to take really stupid steps. But that depends on a government which is amenable to moral suasion, which of course Bojo Jojo the Magic Monkey was not, right? But, you know, and in the other Westminster countries where the Governor General is a political appointee, generally of the people in the current government, it's even worse. But one very useful feature of the Westminster system is that if the supply resolution doesn't pass, then you can wind up with a fresh election. The government is dissolved and you can wind up with a fresh election. Now, the truth is, you know, I mean, the current problem could have been avoided if the House of Representatives had expelled the members who expressed sympathy for the putsch of January 6th, 2021, but including Kevin McCarthy. But it's worse than that, because an election has intervened. Those folks were re-elected by their constituents, who clearly approve of the overthrow of constitutional government in this country. But beyond that, I mean, for most of my lifetime, the U.S. government has been limping along on continuing resolutions and so on, without actually having proper budget bills passed. Constitutional government in the U.S. has been breaking down for a long time. It's just things are beginning to come to a head. I don't want to live under a dictatorship. It's not a good option. Well, with that, I'll remind you that you've been listening to A Step Farther Out, which airs every Saturday at 19 UTC on AnonRadio.net, and AnonRadio is a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System. If you'd like to support me, paypal.me/PrometheusLives, patreon.com/man_and_Adam, although Patreon has changed some things recently, which I don't like at all. Just send me your cards and letters, Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America.